This is Susan Barge interviewing Terence Ryan on November the 18th, 2020. Good morning, Terence.
Good morning, Sue. Very nice to speak to you.
It's
Thank
a
you for
great
arranging.
Pleasure. So we're going to talk for about an hour. And I think the first thing is to find out how you ended up in Oxford studying medicine. So perhaps you can tell me why you chose to become a doctor.
Well, thank you for the question. It happened because I had a rather strong mother who was always a great believer in predicting what I was going to do. And at the age of four, I made medicines for her horses out of whitewash and nettles. And from that time on, she said, Terence is going to be a doctor. And that was so, it never altered. I was always going to be a doctor.
You had a slightly difficult schooling, didn't you?
Terrible, really. This is wartime. My mother, who had run away into the army in the First World War, was called up as early as 1937 to help recruit women into driving. And she became one of the first WAFs. And my father joined the Sherwood Foresters. And as a result of both that, he became a prisoner eventually in Germany. As a result of that, I went to many different schools and really had a terrible education. And eventually, when trying to take common entrance, I was labeled as educationally subnormal. And this resulted in all sorts of things like going to special schools. And those special schools couldn't actually provide me with anything relating to medicine. And there came a point when I'd failed, I think maths or something. And the whole question of how would I get to Oxford, which was the plan of my mother. And
so wait a minute, Terence, your mother must have realized you were not educationally subnormal.
Oh yes, everybody except the person who made the diagnosis thought I was a bright little boy.
Yeah, there was problems with dyslexia, I suppose it would be labeled now, would it?
Yes, I went to a school which was the first to use typewriters, although I didn't use a typewriter, and later became a well-known school for dyslexia. And certainly I know that I have features of dyslexia, but if I'm asked to explain exactly what is wrong with me, I find that very difficult.
Yes, yes.
But I still have some problems which could be labeled as dyslexia. Yeah.
Yeah, so your mother, your pushy mother, then how did you get to Oxford?
Well, the special school I went to was run by a pair of headmasters, one of whom was a Wimbledon tennis player and played with the head of one of the colleges, Worcester College, the famous J.C. Masterman, who was also head of MI5 or something like that at one time. And he took me to a tennis competition in Oxford. And I was interviewed briefly by this famous J.C. Masterman. 10 years later, I was told by the senior tutor of Worcester College that he took pity on me. And indeed, he must have done, because he said I could come, provided I got sort of physics, chemistry, and biology. And so I went to Crammers in London for a whole year, failed physics four times, but eventually got in. I managed to get my biology first time and chemistry second time, but it was a pretty fearsome time. So having got those, and having done a rather good entrance paper to the college entitled Music is the Most Ethereal of the Arts, they did take pity on me and allowed me to come in.
Well, I'll just pick you up on that, because music is another part of your expertise, isn't it, Terence? When did you start playing the piano?
Oh, I started playing piano at nine and didn't really get going until I was given some really good tuition about the age of 14, and then I took it seriously.
Right.
In Oxford, music was more important to me really than working for exams, but and I had a very good time musically in Oxford with lots of musical friends.
Yes. So what were your first impressions of Oxford as a student?
Oh, a wonderful, interesting place. But I remember I was put into an annex of the college, which was a sort of garage, and I couldn't find it. So I went up to a very senior looking man who was actually the senior lawman and said, where is this place? He said, haven't you got any initiative, boy? And that was slightly frightening.
I didn't
have the initiative to find this place on my own, but I eventually found where I was going to stay. And I enjoyed Worcester College and they did take pity on me, but I didn't do very well there. I failed every single exam at least once and went on doing so even when I went to the Radcliffe Infirmary, which I went to rather than London, because my tutor thought, well, he's going to struggle in these important places like St. Thomas's and guys, let's go to this little hospital in Oxford and see how he does there.
So this was the Radcliffe Infirmary, the old Radcliffe.
This was the Radcliffe Infirmary.
So the medicine in those days was very much preclinical, wasn't it? And then you'd move on to do your clinical.
That's what most people did. And there were only an entrance of 8 in my year. And so it was a very good time to be there because in fact we were clerks rather than students. And we had a very good time learning medicine. And I didn't fail my finals.
Brilliant. And who were your inspirational teachers at that stage, Terence? Who were the clinicians that would have been teaching you?
Oh, there were a lot of really quite good people. The point really was that I soon became president of Osler House. And I was involved in 4 pantomimes.
So
I was really known better for, I don't know, not for medicine, I think. And indeed, once when I was picked up by the best job was Sir George Pickering. He's the new Regents Professor. And I was chosen to be his houseman.
So what are we talking about, Terence? If we just give a timeline here. When did you arrive at the Radcliffe Infirmary to do your clinical studies?
1953. Okay. Yes. And as I said, I spent a lot of time doing things like Tintwick.
Wonderful.
I was involved in 4 of them. The president of Osler House and so on. And George Pickering, much later, had to give me a reference. He didn't mention medicine at all. He just said that I was a good chap, really. So I think that's why I got his job.
Were you on stage in Tintwick?
Oh yes, 3 times. And then I was the pianist at one stage.
So
I wrote it, of course, 1 year.
Oh, very good, Terence. Mm. Yeah, so those were good times as a student.
Yes, they were. They were a struggle because there were so few of us. And indeed, as president, I had to support everything. And I found myself playing rugby against Cardiff and against St. George's. And I'd never played anything except soccer before that, all those sort of things. It was a bit of a struggle.
Good, very good. So then you moved on to house jobs and you had the Pickering house job, which must have been a top job.
That was an interesting job. Pickering was an interesting man. And as a result of that, I was invited to be with Ronald Macbeth, who was a fairly senior surgeon, but he was ear, nose and throat surgeon.
Yes.
And with him, being with him resulted in the fact that when I had to do my national service, because I hadn't done it before doing medicine, he knew the head of the Royal Army Medical Corps, who was also an ear, nose and throat surgeon. And I was immediately given a consultant post, although I'd only done 6 months of surgery, ENT surgery. I was given a consultant post and in Colchester, receiving all the evacuations from the British Army of the Rhine and also being a pioneer in doing for the army civilian work. So I did about 200 tonsillectomies and about 200 nose operations.
Gracious.
I didn't really touch the ear. And then I'd said that I was interested in dermatology. So I said, oh, you better be our dermatologist. So I became a consultant dermatologist there. And in the army, that was a stage at which they hadn't even got steroids. They'd still got the old-fashioned mercury and arsenic and various things like that. And I had my own pharmacist.
Very good.
And I received from the British Army of the Rhine and also from the local army prison a lot of patients, a lot of people. And I did a lot of work. But I realised that I wasn't really doing... I wasn't really experiencing the army. So I joined in the early mornings, being MO to a, I think it was a signals regiment.
Right.
And that was quite interesting, disguising one's MO tent with fir trees and various things. It was playing soldiers. At the same time, I also helped run the garrison theatre. And we entered into the British Drama League, I think it is, competitions, annual competitions. And we won first time, then we won the second time, and eventually got to the semi-finals. I was in it. So that was quite fun too.
Well, to go back to the dermatology, had you met somebody as a student who had inspired you? Why dermatology?
Oh yes, well that was important because Alice Carlton was the dermatologist, and Alice Carlton was a famous anatomist. So everybody met her in anatomy, and she was very frightening. She was very witty, quite cruel to the girls, like the boys. But when it was known that, well, it so happened that my father met her brother, and she knew I was coming to do to the dermatology clinic as a student. And because my fellow students, there were three others, knew that she knew me, I was pushed ahead, and therefore I read up dermatology. And I probably knew it better than any other subject by the time I went to the clinic. And that's really how I became a dermatologist. If you got it wrong with her, she would hit you. And if one of her female colleagues tipped you off with the right answer, she would hit her as well. So it was quite an exciting time.
not an approved educational method anymore.
No.
So that didn't put you off dermatology.
No, it led me to be a dermatologist, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, I'd met Renick Vickers. And I told Renick Vickers at one point that I was interested in dermatology because I thought it was the least specialised of the specialities. And he thought that was rather good and put into one of his lectures, which was published in the BMJ, as a bright student who wanted to be a dermatologist. So I had to be a dermatologist.
Okay, so you've done your house jobs, you've done your stint with the army, learnt your ENT skills. I must say, I remember your ENT skills when I worked with you. You used to be able to maneuver one of those mirror things that you put on your forehead.
That's right, yes.
Yes, the only dermatologist I suspect who could do that.
I used to remove the wax of all my colleagues.
Yes.
I don't know if I ever did you, I certainly did to Peter Mortimer.
And then you mentioned this little hurdle of membership.
Well, I'd failed lots of exams going up to medicine, except the finals. And once I started, the problem of having to have membership was everybody knew you had to have membership if you're going to be a dermatologist. Renny Vickers used that, and the chief advisors, one of whom was Ingram, and another was Kalman, both said he's got to have membership. And so I started taking membership, and I found it very difficult. And I think it was probably because I didn't really know how to learn. Something to do with my dyslexia too, because I used to look at an Argyle Robinson pupil or something and give it the wrong name.
Yeah.
The wrong names kept on turning up in membership, which didn't help. So I eventually took that 11 times.
Oh, that must be a record.
It is a recognized thing, really. Yeah.
I should think it's quite expensive as well, Terence.
It was expensive, but it took me up to Edinburgh. It took me to all the other places as well. And it was a struggle and very depressing. But at the same time, I was being successful as a young registrar dermatologist and known to everybody for the various things I was publishing. So everybody thought I was going to be a dermatologist.
Very good.
If I could get membership.
So you finally passed your membership, and then I think you spent time in London?
Well, before that, I'd published one or two quite good papers, which were thought to be lateral thinking.
Ah, is this the direction of growth?
I also started off with a real interest in the blood supply of the skin. That was because I had in my hand an ENT instrument called Jobson Horn, which you took wax out of the ears.
Yes.
I pressed it on the skin and saw that it indented it. And I looked at the indentation under a microscope and saw that in the indentation, I could see the blood vessels much better than normal. And so I began to describe what I saw and became the authority on the anatomy or vasculature of the skin very quickly, because people weren't interested in the blood supply at that time, not really. There'd been a physiologist called Thomas, and there'd been a bit of physiology, but there hadn't really been any dermatology, just a
Fantastic.
Few.
Fantastic. Is that when you wrote your paper on the direction of growth of the epidermis?
Yes, 1956? I just thought that it was peculiar that the epidermis was said to be migrating outwards. When I was interested in blood supply, I knew that everything migrated toward blood supply, if possible. Mm. And I said that to Rennick. He said, oh, well, you better give a paper on it. So I gave a paper on it, and I had stunned silence. And eventually I published it. And 5 years later, probably the most important dermatopathologists in America wrote a paper on Ryan's theory, saying it was wrong.
Right.
But nevertheless, everybody was very pleased that this very important dermatopathologist had thought that my paper was important. And I continued to write papers corresponding with Pincus. That did help my reputation.
Very good.
But after being registrar with Rennick and then senior registrar, he became president of the BAD, and we had the meeting of the BAD in Oxford,
yes,
at which I more or less took over the organization.
Mm.
And so I helped him with his setting up the British Association of Dermatology meeting. I took over the Playhouse, which is the local small theater, and I presented one afternoon a long session on the blood supply of the skin.
Right.
And I also set up, I managed to borrow about 10 long distance microscopes, and I set up on the Saturday morning a session whereby you looked at the blood supply of the skin in different diseases. And so even as a registrar, I was well known and thought to be competing with Newcastle under Sam Schuster.
Very good, very good. So you did spend time in St. John's, I think, did you?
Well, yes. It was decided that I should have a vascular laboratory and be a lecturer at right. London University. And I had this laboratory over in Homerton, next door to Magnus, who was the photobiologist, and next door to the electron microscope. And Charles Carlin organized for some quite senior people to come and be my colleagues,
right.
learning various right. techniques in vasculature. And I had the professor of dermatology from the Lebanon, and I had one or two young
Goodness.
Americans.
And this is, yes, this is all as a trainee still.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. All as a trainee. And then you came back to Oxford as a consultant in 1971, I think.
Yes, that's right. That, you sort of known that I was going to get the job, but there were others competing.
Right.
And the sort of questions I got asked by Darrell Wilkerson, who do you think is the most important, William Byrd or Monteverdi?
Those, oh my goodness.
Those are the sort of questions I got in my, in my interview.
Very
anyway,
good.
And I was appointed.
So what was Oxford like in 1971 as a new consultant?
Oh, very good. And of course I had Rennick Vickers. There were only two of us. And I had Rennick Vickers as a very well-known dermatologist as a senior body. So I was just really learning how to be a consultant from him. And in those days, we had lots and lots of beds.
This was at the Slade?
At the Slade. Indeed, Alice Carlton had 40 beds. Rennick had reduced that. I can't remember how many we had when I joined, but eventually we got down to 12 beds.
Right.
And at the Slade Hospital, which is on the Ring Road,
Yes, and we had infectious diseases next door to it.
We had infectious diseases next door to us, yes. So things like leprosy and things used to go there.
Yes.
As a registrar, Rennick had begun to take an interest in leprosy because the professor of anatomy in Oxford, Graham Waddell, had got the first electron microscope and was studying the innervation of the skin. And the leprosy world wanted him to look at the changes in the skin, the anesthesia, which is characteristic of leprosy. And so, but the only, and he began to take biopsies from Nigeria and so on, but of course they didn't work because they were informalin. And eventually he needed to have leprosy patients in Oxford. So Rennick offered him a bed and then two beds, and eventually got a six-bedded unit built by the Nuffield Foundation. By the time I came back to Oxford, we had this separate unit of leprosy.
Goodness.
And we had employed Colin McDougall, who was a well-known lepologist who'd come from, I think, Singapore at that time. And we began to take patients with leprosy. And we became important for leprosy because we were the first to show resistance to dapsone, which is one of the main drugs for leprosy. And we were the first to show the effectiveness of rifampicin, or let's say it was Colin's work. And I was interested in the blood supply of the nose, which is one of the places which you got leprosy. Mm. And we began to develop a good reputation in leprosy. And I think that, and we also used to get the money from LEPRA and various other organizations. So our research money came from leprosy.
So these patients were coming from elsewhere?
They were all outside England. They'd come in as immigrants from Uganda and Amin was there, and they came from the Philippines. There were about 600 cases of leprosy in the country at that time.
Goodness.
And I myself would organize seminars quarterly, and all the dermatologists, the famous lepologists from around the world, Paul Brand and Cochrane and so on, all the real big names in leprosy, used to come to those seminars. So right. It was a very good experience.
Yes, yes. Well, there's been a big change in the management of leprosy, I guess, over
Absolutely,
your lifetime.
Because we later became the centre for doing the studies of histopathology of leprosy following triple therapy.
Yes.
And if it hadn't been for us, there wouldn't have been an elimination programme.
Right.
So Colin McDougall, he was also editor of the main journal, which is Leprosy
yes.
Review.
Yes.
We were the centre for leprosy.
Amazing.
Research.
Very good. Now, what about your links with the physicians in the old Radcliffe, it would have been still back then? So you
yes.
were coming up to the Slade for your...
Again, my interest in blood supply was appropriate. I became known for my interest in leg ulcers. And at that time, leg ulcers were dealt with by physiotherapists, rheumatologists, geriatricians. Oh, everybody was doing leg ulcers.
Yeah.
And it was eventually decided that we should take charge. And that really meant me take charge of leg ulcers. And I brought in a zoologist from America who was doing, at that time, a PhD in the surgery department. That was George Cherry.
Yes.
He was a zoologist and he was interested in blood supply. And for his PhD, he worked with me a little bit on the blood supply of skin flaps. Bringing in George Cherry was a very good move because we began not only to work on leg ulcers, but on wound healing in general.
Yes.
And George Cherry attracted quite a lot of money from the industry. And that was really the second source of major money for research. We had
right.
lepra and we had wound healing.
And I'm trying to explore how you got on with the other physicians in Oxford. Did dermatology interact with other physicians particularly?
Yes, or? I mean, mainly really through Rennick Vickers to begin with, because he had always said that it was very important to show the importance of dermatology to your colleagues. And he set up a very good relationship. He became chairman of the medicine board, as
right.
indeed I did later. And he was chairman of the medicine board. So he had good relationships from the administration point of view. when he retired, I suppose it was about 6 to 8 years later, following my appointment.
1976, I think he retired. I've got
quite early on, really, yes. And then I became the senior man and eventually decided that someone who had worked with me both in London doing research between London and Oxford, I had been appointed as a dermatologist at the World Postgraduate Medical School for 2 years.
Yes.
That was a two-day session. And when I left there, this person who'd worked with me, which was Rodney Dauber, he took over at the Hammersmith.
Yes.
And then he went to Stoke. And I decided that we had such a good relationship and he was such an enthusiastic person on all subjects. He was not just a single interest, but had many interests, that I would like him to come. And Rennick thought, who had just retired, thought it was a very good idea, and went to see Rodney and said, "You must come." and persuaded him to come to Oxford. So I had Rodney as a colleague.
Mm. Yes, and who else were physicians then? So you'd have had John Leddingham, was he around then?
Yes, he was. Interacting with? I didn't know John all that well. I mean, I got to know him much later, but I suppose the people I knew were still the people that I'd worked with even as a student, like Sheila Callender and John Badenoch and all those sort of people. In fact, yeah. I wrote papers with them on methotrexate.
Right.
Sheila Callender and John Badenoch were co-authors on the first paper on folic acid antagonists in this country.
Yes. And were you still having things to do with Tindrick, Terence, then?
I played piano once for them, yes. That's all.
So you saw the medical students, they were still coming through dermatology, were they?
Oh, yes. They were still coming. Yes, definitely. And I was by that moment, by that time, senior member of Tinchwick, so I had to vet the program.
So you became a senior member. So you were very much involved with Tinchwick then?
Oh, yes, very much so, yes. Yes.
Yes.
I continued to be for years until I outgrew it, really.
Very good. So we've now got a unit with you and with Rodney, and you've still got your wound healing and your leprosy work going on.
Wound healing. We began to get good technicians like Richard Jones.
Yes.
Richard Jones came as the pig man because George needed pigs for his skin flaps. And Richard Jones came to from the Royal Agricultural College in Cirencester, which he didn't manage very well, and came to us as a technician and grew up and took lots of senior exams, became very, very good, well-qualified technician, and eventually became our administrator.
Yes. So tell me about the Slade. What was the Slade like?
Slade was marvellous. It had a lovely garden. It had single rooms. Patients loved it. And the nurses were always extremely good. We had a Mr. Haynes, who was an expert on leg ulcers. And then eventually Rennick got him an MBE. But we also had people like Benedict Wilders, some wonderful nurses. And eventually I became very interested in the development of nursing and wound healing.
Yes.
And we got some very senior nurses gradually. And at one point I took on Stephen Ursa, who was a senior nurse already at Oxford, and he introduced me to become a member of the Institute of Nursing, and I also became on the regional health authorities nursing representative and so on. So
was,
I became very close.
Was it
yes,
unusual?
It was. I became very closely involved with nursing. And nurses then began to come to me, diabetic nurses would come to me and say, "Look here, we're doing diabetes, we're doing lots of research, why can't we take university exams?" And then there was wound healing who wanted to take exams, there was pressure ulcers who wanted to take exams. And Basil Shepston and I worked very closely for about 14 years trying to get them into Oxford University. But they kept on presenting their work with very educational and sociological language, and not sufficiently scientific from them, and so we never got them there. But Brooks University took them instead. And then they took me as well and gave me a title of professor at Brooks in the nursing department. That I was the first at Brooks consultant to have that appointment. And it caused a bit of a stir. And I was brought to the office of Henry Harris and told not to use the title, which I didn't for a while until they gave me one themselves.
So tell me, how did you really get inspired, or how did you see the importance of nurses? Why was it that you were one of the trailblazers in developing dermatology nursing, do you think?
Well, by that time, we'd also taken on lymphology. I'd become into, after my success, publications of books and various things on blood vessels, I began to take up lymphatics as well. And that led to lymphedema. And that led us to being asked by patients who had had mastectomies and got lymphedema of the arm. There was a mastectomy society to start taking interest. And I then found that palliative care under Robert Tricos had, of course, a lot of lymphedema for one reason or another and was struggling with it. But yes, he brought in some really excellent nurses to manage lymphedema in palliative care. And they too, plus the research nurses from diabetes and the research nurses from pressure ulcers, which was a major problem in the surgical department or throughout the hospitals, led us to become a focus for development of research for nursing. And we'd got that link with Brooks as well. And it was really these contacts with people, nurses who were doing good research, and us as the sort of figurehead for research in wound healing with pressure ulcers and leg ulcers, which led us to be in the fore.
Yes.
So far as that concerned. But we always had to take into account dermatology nursing, and we established a link with St. Thomas's there as well.
So had there been a British dermatology nursing group before that?
No, we started that.
Yes.
We started the British... British Dermatology Nursing Group. And well, from that, we developed also the International Skincare Nursing Group, which became affiliated to the work, to the International Council of Nursing.
Right.
And I got them involved in lymphedema, particularly on the west coast of Africa, where there was a lot of lymphedema due to filariasis. We became part of the nursing role in managing lymphedema worldwide.
I suppose that takes us on then really to your international work, Terence, because you've done a lot, haven't you?
Yes, because I've been interested in various things. Darrell Wilkinson, who was the most important dermatologist in the Oxford region, he had written the Rook book, the best textbook of dermatology with Arthur Rook, and involved me in several of the chapters, particularly the vascular ones, the leg ulcers and all that sort of thing. And at one stage, because I think of my links with lymphedema worldwide and lymphatic filariasis and various things, we began to interest Darrell Wilkinson in international work. And he had been called onto the International Committee of Dermatology. Now, the International Committee of Dermatology specialized in setting up world congresses. That's all it was interested in. But it was a very competitive thing, and only the top dermatologists got elected from around the world. And they were only interested in the world congress. Darrell Wilkinson took a different view, that they, being such an important elected committee, they ought to be taking interest in the resource-poor countries and doing something about it. And he began to set up this idea and thought that I would be a suitable person to support it, and involved me all the way along with his thinking. Indeed, also in fundraising for a small bank fund to support it. I think we got about £700 from dermatologists, and I was one of the co-trustees, as it were. So eventually, Darrell Wilkinson wanted to retire from the International Committee and thought that I was the most important person to do it. And I got lots of letters from these senior dermatologists welcoming me. But eventually, when we went to the World Congress in Mexico, and I was going to be appointed, out came Hugh Wallace, who said, "I'm sorry, but they think you won't get elected because you're too young." And we persuaded Darrell Wilkerson to stay on a bit longer. So I didn't get it then, but I got it 5 years later.
Yes.
Competing with some of the senior dermatologists in Britain against them, who were professors. And I was, right. At that time, I wasn't a professor.
Yes.
So I didn't think I'd get it, but I did get it because of Darrell Wilkerson and all his friends.
So the work that you've done internationally, you've done on the leprosy front, the wound healing front, the lymphatic front, all sorts of things?
Yes. I mean, that's where I came in. But of course, directly I was elected, that was in Berlin, to the International Committee. It became clear that they should have a separate branch, which they called the International Foundation for Dermatology. And I got elected onto that. And I was one of the five more active members. Al Kopf, who was a famous dermatologist with his practice on the top of the Empire State Building in New York. a very good
Stuart Madden
in Vancouver, who's excellent with industry and getting money. And there were a group of us who did site visits in Africa, and we decided on Africa. And we had the ambassador to Venezuela, Colonel Vegas, who was also a dermatologist. And we started going to places like Africa and setting up the regional dermatology training center.
In Moshi. Yes.
I was very much involved in that with Grossman, who was the person who knew most about Africa and came from Germany. So I was very much involved in that, and then later became involved with the on that committee with the French group, who were very jealous of our English activities and wanted to set up a program in West Africa. So I went to Mali,
yes,
and helped set up there, and then a French-speaking system,
yes.
And then the ambassador to Guatemala in London turned out to be a dermatologist also. Well, no, turned out to be a doctor who wanted to learn dermatology. And he was at the Institute of Dermatology learning dermatology and decided that he wanted to have a training center in Guatemala. As his sister was married to the president of Guatemala, then it was easy to do. So I got very much involved in setting up a training center for nurses in Guatemala in rural areas.
Yes.
Which was Guatemala's a difficult place. The dermatologists didn't like the idea at all in Guatemala because they thought they'd take their private practice.
Mm-hmm.
The very first visit we paid there, we went to a hospital site, which we thought might be suitable for us, but found it had been involved in a massacre the night before. And anyone who was involved was teaching things like nurses in rural areas, which was thought to be a communist anyway. So it was a very difficult time. And we only had 5 years there.
Yes.
But we did teach, we did set up a center there, mostly helped by from America. And the nurses, there were about 250 nurses, which we taught in rural areas of Guatemala very successfully. And they didn't take the private practice away from the dermatologists. They actually increased them by 5,000 per year because they knew they could recognize things in the skin. And they weren't afraid of referring them.
Yes. Yes.
So it was a very good move, really.
So
and then I decided I wanted to do China.
Right. Well, China is an interesting place to do, Terence. So what happened in China?
Well, long story there, really, in that very early on, I'd looked after a woman who had been married to one of the Chinese most famous visitors, the surgeon to Mao, for his army. It was a Canadian, and she'd been married to him twice, and I'd looked after her, and I'd got to know a bit about China. And then when I was president of the World Congress of Microcirculation in Oxford, the Chinese were it was the first visit of the Chinese really to a Congress in Britain. And they brought evidence of herbal activity during a meningitis epidemic, preventing shock in babies. And as a result of that, I became an honorary member of the Microcirculation Society in Beijing. And began to have relationships with some of the Chinese medicine development in the vascular field. I was also chairman of all microcirculation societies around the world, helping them to decide when to have the next congress and where and so on. So I was quite involved with the Chinese at that time who wanted to have a congress. And then later in China, Colin McDoodle had invited the man who's very successfully eliminating leprosy from China, who is another expatriate who had learned about syphilis in America. And he helped to abolish or to control syphilis in China. And then he took on leprosy. And he came to Oxford, even stayed with us at our house once, a man called Ma Hyde. So I got involved with the Chinese leprosy elimination program.
Right.
And then later, when I was on the international committee, decided that we should, it would be a good idea to have a regional dermatology training center in China. This was actually proposed by one of the Chinese dermatologists in Xi'an, who had a student learning dermatology there who became actually my secretary in the organization. We set up a program in Nanjing for training of doctors in towns to teach the barefoot doctors, the so-called village doctors. And we set up a program and we worked on it for about 2 years, but eventually four people went to prison for spending all the money on buying lasers to treat wrinkles in Shanghai.
Right.
And that, and as the international committee wasn't particularly interested in China, only I, they were rather glad to drop it, I think.
So, yes. So very good. So all those international activities, I'm going to drag you back to Oxford now, so yes, we can think a little bit more about how things changed over your time here. So when you started, the hospital was based at the old Radcliffe and we were out at the Slade for inpatients. What changed over your time?
And eventually, of course, the Radcliffe Infirmary closed and the John Radcliffe started and we had a new outpatients there.
How did that work?
That worked much better. It was much bigger and it brought us, all of us, a bit more centrally into the center of Oxford Medicine. By that time, I'd become, I think, chairman of, I was not on the medicine board, it was the Faculty of Medicine, so-called Faculty of Medicine.
Right.
I was chairman of that.
Right.
I got quite involved with the John Radcliffe affairs. I'd had a World Congress there and so on. So the outpatients worked very well.
Can you just contrast, Terence, the outpatients in the old Radcliffe with the facilities in the new John Radcliffe? My memory of the old Radcliffe is of tiled floors and a table and patients all able to hear each other. Is that right or wrong? How did it work?
It was much better. It wasn't staggeringly better, but it was much better, and we were able to have more sessions. I mean, at the Radcliffe Infirmary, there was only one waiting room and a few rooms for outpatients, which you had to share with everybody else.
Yes,
including sexually transmitted diseases. I might mention sexually transmitted diseases worldwide are managed by dermatology, but not in this country because we have venereology in this country.
Yeah.
And sexually transmitted diseases had to share with us at the Radcliffe Infirmary the space. But once we got to the John Radcliffe, they stayed down in the Radcliffe Infirmary.
Right.
And we didn't have to share with so many people. So we had the place more or less to ourselves. Whereas in the Radcliffe Infirmary, we only had it for one day.
Right.
Whereas in the John Radcliffe, we really had it for any day we liked.
So we had only one day of clinics in the old Radcliffe. That was it.
Outpatients clinics, yes. Friday afternoons, I think it was, yes. Because things have changed a lot in dermatology, because in those days, we had our surgical and our walk clinic at the Slade Hospital.
Right.
And we kept the ward clinic at the Slade Hospital, and we kept our surgical session at the Slade Hospital. But it was only one morning a week.
Tell me about the surgery facilities at the Slade, Terence. What was that room like?
We had a theatre. We had a theatre, a table. Yes. I used to go to Harwell to get liquid nitrogen on yes. Thursday mornings. And we had a session for warts using liquid nitrogen.
Yes.
And we then went on and did some surgery for about 2 hours.
So the surgery, when you say we had a theatre, can you just describe, just for the listeners, what you mean by the word theatre? Because
it was a room which had washing facilities and two tables, and that's all. And we didn't have anaesthetics or anything like that.
We had local anaesthetic.
We had local anaesthetic, of course, yes.
But when it was hot, I have a recollection we opened the doors.
Yes,
the garden.
Let the sun in, let the air in, that sort of thing. Yes, it's just a white, clean room. Yes. Very different to what we have now. I mean, there were two of us on for one morning a week doing surgery. Nowadays, there are 15 dermatologists in a full-time surgery.
Yes.
At the Churchill.
And when you were doing your surgery back then, did you wear a mask? Did you wear gloves?
No, none of that sort of thing. Because we were dealing with warts, which didn't need anything, and we were dealing with curettage of rodent ulcers.
Yes.
if they were big, they went to plastic surgery.
Yes.
So we did have a combined clinic, both with radiotherapy and with plastic surgery.
Yes.
I think okay. Once more.
That's very good. And then the other thing that's changed over the years while you were a consultant was you got more colleagues. So Rodney came in to replace Rennick, but then who else joined you?
It was quite a long time before we got Fenella Wojanowska, and we could only get her part-time. She had to work at Wickham and Amersham as well right. as with us. And she was only part-time with us, and she wanted to do research.
Yes.
The amount of time she had for clinical work with us was quite small, but she was a third consultant. What we shouldn't forget is that we had by now got to the stage where we had not only a registrar, but a senior registrar, and we had both.
Right.
And they were all excellent, and they were all capable of innovation. And I think each one of you, including yourself, took on a new topic for development.
Yes.
And became well known for it.
Yes.
You yourself helped, I think, with lupus erythematosus, and then took on relationships with the medical school.
Yes, yes.
Well, others, Peter Mortar, became a world famous lymphologist.
Yeah.
And so on. Sheila Powell came with us too, but actually before she came with Sheila Johnson. She had worked with Colin in Africa.
Right.
And she came to us, and eventually she came as a senior registrar. These were all part-time married women. We were very lucky that we had Rosemary Rue developing the idea that married women should be able to get work even if they were pregnant. And we benefited from that enormously in that a lot of our registrars were part-time married women.
Yes.
And very, very good ones at that.
I mean, yes. So the field of dermatology, the whole field has changed, I think, because we have now so many more women consultant dermatologists nationally, internationally too, I suppose.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's always regarded as a very suitable job for women because it didn't, you know, the old thing of not getting you up at night and all that sort of thing.
Yes. Can I just pull you back to your relationships with infectious diseases who were on the same site of the Slade? Was David Worrell there? Who would you have been working with there? Or was Warren? Was it there?
Dr. Warren, he was the medical officer of health for Oxfordshire. And he was quite an academic man. And he was an examiner for bacteriology and various things like that. And they had, initially, they had the only cases of leprosy. Until we had our ward, then we began to our unit for leprosy with six beds.
Yes, so we worked with them.
But within a year, we'd shown that rifampicin made you no longer infectious.
Yes.
It cleared your nose and that sort of thing. There was no dust on the floor with leprosy in it. So we turned the whole thing into the whole of the bedded unit for leprosy. We turned it into research, including bringing in Professor of Anatomy, Graham Waddell, up with his electron microscope and his people.
So what do you
over
think?
In the infectious diseases unit, we had a good relationship with them.
Yes.
I suppose we would visit them about once a month, see something they were interested in.
Right, but you weren't collaborating on the leprosy research particularly.
We weren't collaborating, no.
No.
Indeed, it was more difficult than that because the leprosy in this country was, from the government point of view, was run by a senior man called Cochrane, who spent most of his time in India. And when we had a patient who was making death aids and had multibacillary leprosy, the medical officer of health questioned whether it was safe for her to make death aids and whether we wouldn't end up with thousands of people in Oxford with leprosy of the ear from death aids. Cochrane said, it isn't really a problem. I'll be back with you in 6 months' time. Let's discuss it then. You know, he didn't see any urgency at all. And the poor medical officer of health was very bemoozled by the whole business of how you should manage leprosy.
But you were able to step in and sort it out, were you?
Well, once we got rid of Amson, had very good evidence that
yes.
it cleared infectivity.
Okay, I'm going to move sideways again because another of your skills alongside your dermatology and your wound healing and your piano is your watercolour paintings, which have decorated many of the hospitals in Oxford. How did you get into watercolours, Terence?
My father painted. As I mentioned earlier, I'd been to many schools, some of which were quite arty. Rudolf Steiner School, for instance. So I became quite interested in art in general, looking at art and that so on. But I didn't really take up painting until I was in Japan and realized that the way the Japanese painted was something that I thought I could copy. And I began initially painting a bit like the Japanese with charcoal pens and things. And eventually quite successful, as I'm sitting here. One of my first paintings is just behind me, actually, where I used a bit of the Japanese way of painting. And then it became something I did. I used to produce about, they were quite big. And I was asked, I think, by the John Radcliffe to be in charge of the decor.
Ah.
And I did that with Manny Lee, who's the surgeon. Manny Lee was a good artist. Manny Lee and I used to go up to London to art galleries and things, and we used to buy things. And some of the paintings that are in the John Radcliffe, I bought with Manny Lee. He introduced me to one or two artists, and by that time, Green College had started, and they needed an art gallery too, so I was involved in that. And the corridors in the John Radcliffe and at the Churchill were enormously long. We couldn't afford to decorate them with expensive things from London galleries. So took on a new idea, which is to buy very cheaply Japanese wallpapers, get my son to make cheap frames. And the corridor down, right down to the transplant unit and renal area is decorated by wallpaper. Japanese wrapping papers.
Okay.
And then that looked so successful, they're quite attractive, that I took Thai silk scarves and painted them. And then took, I think it was cushions, Indian cushions, covers. We turned them into art. So we looked at cheap ways. we got quite a lot of artists, proper artists, to donate to us. Some quite good artists did that. And I began to put up some of my paintings. When we got the new building, I began to put some of my paintings up there.
What did you think of that? There used to be a sculpture outside the John Radcliffe, that thing like a windmill that whirled around.
I got that. And of course, it was fiercely, fiercely criticised by the Oxford Mail for spending money. But he had to point that the money didn't come from patient care. And actually, apart from the fact that it needed replacing every now and again, because the sails, it was a windmobile, which I actually copied from the dermatology department in Miami. It needed replacing about every 3 years, and that was a bit expensive. But in spite of the criticism of the Oxford Mail, it became the place where everybody took photographs. So if there was anything, a photograph of anything in the John Radcliffe, it was always by that sail, including by the Oxford Mail. And it was quite, it became a feature of the John Radcliffe, quite an important one.
Iconic. And the other thing, of course, the John Radcliffe has is that garden at the front. Were you involved with that as well? Because I know you have a love of gardening.
Yes, I wasn't particularly involved in that one, but
But you had a garden in the new dermatology unit.
Oh, yes. Yes. Of course, we'd had the garden at the Slade. And the Slade, from time to time, when they were trying to cut down useless hospitals, we had lots of campaigns to try and keep the Slade because patients liked it so much because of the gardens. And we realized that gardens are extremely important.
Yes.
And they continued, and I published articles on the importance of gardens for health and trees and so on. I've published a few articles like that because it is important for health. And so when we moved to the Churchill, we also had built a garden there.
Yes.
It's very important.
Well, Terence, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Is there anything else I should ask you? Is there anything else you'd like to tell me about?
I don't remember what are we talking about? I ought to mention that all the time was that I was there, Mr. Haynes, who was the chief nurse at the Radcliffe, at the Slade Hospital when we first started, was also with St. John Ambulance. And yes. he asked me to do some lectures for St. John Ambulance. This led me to become I can't remember what they called them now, but a surgeon to one down in St. Ebbs, which is the sort of poor area. And directly I was appointed as a member of St. John Ambulance. Suddenly got a call from London saying Churchill had died, would I manage his funeral arrangements in Woodstock at Bladen. And so they had to get me into a uniform for that. And they couldn't find a hat that was big enough. And it was a terrible business. And eventually I didn't know what I was doing really. I'd done it in the army, had a little bit about mass injuries and the like. So I set up, I requisitioned a house in Bladen as a hospital for all the casualties that are likely to occur. And I eventually got my uniform. There were about 3,000 police and there were about 200 civil defense ladies, lots of Boy Scouts and the like. But Mrs. Churchill said it should be a private funeral. We'd had a very big funeral in London that morning. It was a very cold day. No one turned up at all. There were absolutely nothing in the way of casualties. But we had this huge house with I turned into a hospital and all this soup that had to be eaten. Well, I did see Churchill go by. And then I joined St. John and very gradually I became in charge of St. John Ambulance for the whole of Oxfordshire. That meant that I was basically in charge of such things as preparations for war, because there was a time when we were very close to war with Upper Hayford near us, and Alec Gather wanted someone to help him. And we had an underground bunker in Woodeaton where we could plan war. And so Alec Gather and I planned what we were going to do with the populations of Oxford. And I worked with the Red Cross on this. I got a little bit of practice because when I started, St. John Ambulance was in charge of the ambulance service. So I found myself with an ambulance service. I didn't really have they were good administrators. I didn't really have to do anything about it until he died, and then I had to give the after dinner the oration. But so I had very little to do with the ambulance service, unless there was a strike. And when there was a strike, and that occurred about two times, I had to provide the ambulance service from St. John Ambulance and Red Cross. So I was in charge of that. And also we had illegal pop festivals,
right,
which I had to organize. They went on for about 2 weeks. Yes. And with the health service, well, David Waring and people, we had to organize the health service. And we did it with St. John Ambulance people. So it was, I was quite busy with St. John Ambulance.
Well, I think you've had an incredible life, Terence. You've done so much from a slightly inauspicious start and then progressing through to become a leading dermatologist. It's really been a huge pleasure talking to you. And I'm sure—
Can I just say that I haven't stopped?
No, you haven't stopped.
It's now 25 years or so since I retired.
Yes.
And I'm just as busy zooming to India, China, and Pakistan.
Yes.
I've continued to work internationally. Of course, I gave up MDU and I gave up all my connections with dermatology in this country.
And you've
it hasn't stopped me elsewhere.
And you've got the Friends of Norham Gardens as well. We haven't really touched on that. All the activities that you've done for the alumni.
Well, that's through Green College, because I became a member of Green College and vice warden of Green College and so on.
Yes.
And then John Walton asked me to take over. He had his office in 13 Norham Garden. He was a great Osler man. So he asked me to take that over. And I gradually developed that into a quite good place.
Good. Well, thank you so much for talking to us.